From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, an EPA scientist calls out the Trump administration over its proposed EPA budget cuts.
Now, what you keep hearing from the administration is, we want the EPA cut so the states can take over. States don't have the money to do this. They don't have the resources. They don't have, it's just not there.
A challenge to charitable foundations. Listen to the community you want to help.
It's not something you do to the community, it's something you do with the community.
She's a mom, an entrepreneur, and she's invented a hands-free breast pumping device that goes anywhere you go.
Totally hands-free. I've driven while I'm using it. I've typed on the computer. I've chopped the vegetables. Like, you know, you can pretty much do anything.
And using poetry to help people to better mental health. Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some say Detroit's old approach to philanthropic giving needs an overhaul. Later in the hour, we'll explore new ways to connect big foundations to small community groups. Plus, we'll hear from a Michigan mom who turned her motherhood experiences into a good business opportunity. But first, perhaps no state in the nation is more aware of water safety than Michigan. Seeing the Flint water disaster play out since 2014 has given us all a very harsh lesson in not taking safe water for granted. Yet President Trump's proposed budget takes an axe to the EPA's budget, one of the agencies most responsible for protecting our water and our infrastructure. Here with us is Keith Fosinski. He's on the front lines monitoring drinking water, and he's vice president of Local 704 of the American Federation of Government Employees. He got his PhD in microbiology and immunology from Wayne State University, where he's an adjunct professor. Keith, first off, tell us about the duties your job entails.
So I have a couple of different jobs. One is, like you said, I'm the Vice President of the American Federation of Government Employees. I represent EPA employees across six states, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Ohio. And then I also serve, my day job is I'm a toxicologist for EPA.
So you are acutely aware of the health risk from contaminated water. Certainly, Flint goes down in history as one of the worst examples of this with lead and Legionella and chemical contamination. And those of us who have followed the story closely know it was EPA Region 5 water expert Miguel Del Toro, who was one of the few heroes trying to get the state and the former Region 5 administrator, Susan Hedman, to listen to his warnings about Flint water. So how does the proposed Trump budget threaten that kind of frontline work?
Well, I'll tell you, one thing people don't tend to realize is 60% of the EPA's budget is actually flow-through. The money comes to EPA, and we basically distribute it to states and local municipalities for them to use on low-income or low-interest loans to fix their infrastructure and replace it. So when they cut the money that's coming to the agency, they're cutting money that's actually going to the states. Now, what you keep hearing from the administration is, we want the EPA cut so the states can take over. States don't have the money to do this. It's just not there. But when you cut the money from the EPA, you're basically cutting the money from the states and local municipalities and tribes.
And what about in terms of having to lay people off at the EPA?
Well, they're just doing now they're doing what's called a VERA and VSIP, which is basically they're doing early buyouts for people who are almost ready to retire, but not quite. So they're actually giving them early outs.
So the ranks are being thinned.
They're being thinned.
So as we talk about that the flow-through grants are going to hit states hard, that money won't be coming from the EPA, and thinning the ranks at the EPA. As we talk about that, how many more Flints do you think are out there, communities in danger of unsafe water?
All of them. All of our infrastructure is falling apart. It's all old. There's nothing being done. Right now it's being estimated that we need $384 billion over the next 20 years to replace our water system. It's only being funded at about $863 million a year. We're never going to reach the tipping point of giving people clean water if we're not funding it like we should be. These revolving funds that we have, the state revolving fund, basically for every dollar that the EPA gives the states get $2 worth of investment. So if we actually funded that $19 billion a year, in 20 years, 10 years actually, we can have all of our infrastructure, all of our drinking water infrastructure across the country replaced and have clean drinking water at any faucet across the country.
And instead, this 2018 proposed budget from the president would cut more than $600 million
right.
from these drinking water-related programs and grants?
Right. The newest budget that's just been approved, that's going to get approval now, been approved at the Appropriations Committee, now it's going to the full House, has cut us by 6%.
So what you're saying is we're going backwards.
We're going backwards. What you saw in Flint is going to happen everywhere across the country. It already is happening in other places. It's not very well publicized, but it's happening.
But it is. It's staggering to think when we realize that it has been all of this time since the wraps came off of what's going on in Flint, and still just a fraction of the water infrastructure has been changed out. The cost, the time, and the effort, and the idea of having to basically retrofit the country, I think it's hard to wrap your mind around that.
True. There's other ways of doing it. I mean, not just in the drinking water infrastructure, just society as a whole, if we change the way we do things and actually educate people on how to go about, you know, doing the construction work. If we educate the masses, you know, how to do the infrastructure, how to do the plumbing, and get them out there to do it, we have the people that can do it. There's so many unemployed people in the country right now. We can train them. We can get them out in the field, putting the pipes in the ground. But it's just not happening. Our investments are going other directions. You know, I do human health for a living, and I don't see why we can't spend the money on keeping our American people safe.
People, Keith, who care about the environment and care about environmental justice, they look at the person chosen by the president to head the EPA, Scott Pruitt, someone who spent his tenure as Oklahoma's attorney general continually suing the EPA for its efforts to regulate mercury and smog and other forms of pollution. And they wonder, will the EPA be the environmental guardian that we need under Scott Pruitt? I mean, will scientists like you be able to do the work you know needs doing?
The easy answer for that is no. I will tell you, I am the only person, the only toxicologist that serves six states in the function that I do. Anything happens 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, I'm the one they call. When I first started, there was four of me. Now there's only one, and they have yet to even look at hiring another one.
It's a mighty thin safety net.
Yes.
What do you think are the lessons that the EPA, Region 5 and nationally, learned from what happened in Flint? I mean, the failures of government at so many levels leading up to and after Flint was switched from Detroit water to the Flint River water included the EPA. So what lessons did the agency learn from Flint?
I hope they learned that communication is key, that when someone on the front line like myself or Miguel Del Toro says, hey, there's a problem, we shouldn't jump up and say, oh, wait, that hasn't been, you know, vetted by the agency yet. If those of us on the front line say, yeah, we have a problem, this needs to be fixed, there should be 100% commitment to fix that problem instead of trying to cover it up and blame other people. I mean, there's a big disconnect between the city of Flint, the state of Michigan, and the EPA on who did what, when, where, and how. As soon as the first data came out and Miguel Del Toro said, yeah, there's an issue here, there should have been a lot more communication working together to get that situation solved. It should have never went as long as it did before something happened.
Again, knowing that your mission is to keep people healthy, what's the takeaway from what we're talking about right now as the budget makes its way, as the EPA budget makes its way through Congress? What's the call to action?
The best thing to do is call your congressmen and senators and tell them they need to fund the agency to its fullest potential. We can't keep cutting the agency's budget because we can't keep protecting people. Our hands are already tied as it is. As one of the president of my local says, basically, we have a dog with no teeth. We can't do anything to fix the problem if people ain't giving us the resources to do it.
Keith Fazinski, Vice President of Local 704 of the American Federation of Government Employees. Keith, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
In a place that can get as cold as Michigan, lots of us try to soak up as much summer sun as we can. But as at Bronner's Christmas Wonderland in Frankenmuth, every day, even in July, is the holiday season. Stateside's Kathleen Davis has more.
The day I'm recording this, it's approaching 90 degrees outside, and the humidity is relentless. But when I pull onto Christmas Lane in Frankenmuth, I suddenly wonder what season it is. Bronner's Christmas Wonderland is a year-round destination in Michigan. It's one of the main attractions of Frankenmuth. That's a cozy little tourist town sometimes called Little Bavaria. But what exactly is Bronner's?
Well, Bronner's is the world's largest Christmas store.
That's Wayne Bronner, owner of Bronner's Christmas Wonderland. He's wearing a bright red suit and a Christmas-themed tie. He says it's his daily uniform. Bronner's is, without a doubt, overwhelmingly large.
We have 320,000 square feet underneath the roof, and we rent another 50,000 square foot of warehouse off-premise. And we're able to park 1,500 cars at one time, and we're blessed to have 2 million people visit us every year.
Even in July. Bronner says some years, visitors from 100 countries sign the store's guestbook. With that kind of geographic diversity, he says the store is probably enjoyed by some people who aren't Christian. Frankenmuth's tourism site says Bronner's main store is the same size as 1.5 football fields. It's also incredibly eclectic.
Golf green ornament for the golfers, firefighter ornaments are very popular. Tennis ball ornament for the people.
Aside from what the average visitor sees, the warehouse space attached to the store is almost twice as big as the main floor. A team of talented employees is dedicated to perfecting Bronner's type of calligraphy. A few of them are already painting ornaments for the holiday season.
Hi, right here is a customer order that I'm working on. These are all wet right now. I just finished them.
Max Misko is one of them.
So most of us were artists before we started here, but then they train us to do this specific font so that they all look pretty much the same. That way you get something consistent because a lot of people order year after year.
I'm introduced to Angie Ferris, a floor manager. She was drawn to working at Bronner's because, well, she loves Christmas.
I always go all out, decorate my whole house and the outside, so it's fun working here.
I ask Ferris the most pressing question on my mind. Does she get sick of listening to Christmas music day after day, no matter what season it is?
People ask me that all the time, and you know, after a while you kind of block it out, but I'm a big Elvis fan, so as soon as Elvis comes on, it's like, Elvis, you know, so I'm all chipper and singing along.
I ask Bronner how he stays in the holiday spirit all year round. This is a man who, after all, wished me happy 164 days until Christmas when I first shook his hand.
Christmas evokes positive emotions. When you think about Christmas time, there's really nothing negative about it. It's all about friendship and warmth and fellowship. So it might be 90 degrees and humidity to match outside, and people are shopping in their t-shirts and shorts and flip-flops. Before you know it, they're singing Christmas carols and putting goodies in their baskets. So we just enjoy seeing the smiles on visitors' faces.
Coming up, two Grand Rapids poets are crisscrossing the country to spread a message of mental health awareness to adults.
Too many times we have people, especially adults, who shove everything in a closet and is like, all right, I don't have to deal with it.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Candy.
Vision. Creation.
The next idea.
You need to tell a story.
Caring for a baby takes up a huge amount of time, but our latest contributor to The Next Idea managed to find the time while caring for her baby to come up with an idea for a product, pitch it in entrepreneurial competitions, win, and make her idea become reality. The Pump and Do. The slogan, because mom life doesn't stop when you pump. Julie Burrell of West Michigan, pleasure to welcome you to The Next Idea.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So let's get everybody who's listening on the same page to help understand your product. So for those who are not familiar with the process of breast pumping, and I'm sure as you did entrepreneurial competitions, you were facing a lot of folks, men who didn't know what it was about. What would you ordinarily have to do to pump?
Breastfeeding in general, you have to keep up your milk supply, right? So whether you are a mom who pumps occasionally or an exclusive pumper or whatever, it's all supply and demand. So you have to keep up that schedule of pumping or else nursing your baby. And so especially when you're away from your baby, whether you're at work or whatever, you have to keep up on that schedule, right? So your breast pumps, the most common is a double electric, and that's typically what your insurance would provide you. And so it has two funnels that you basically hold to your breast so that they can, you know, have the suction and get the milk out and all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have a hands-free device, you're literally holding these funnels to your body for, you know, the entire pump session.
How long could that last?
Up to 45 minutes is typically how long I had to pump because my body didn't respond to a pump as great as it does for other people. So it's all different for every woman, which is frustrating, but that's just kind of how it is. So yeah, you'd have to do that. And then every 2 to 3 hours, you have to repeat the process again. So as you can imagine, being able to do anything else, it makes it kind of impossible.
So how does the Pump and Do change that?
Oh, my goodness. So when my first daughter was born, I didn't want to buy something that was a hands-free option because, of course, there are a lot of options out there. They're expensive and they, you know, require you to either change bras or to like wrap a device completely around you. And it just seemed really cumbersome. So I just, you know, DIY'd something. I took an old bra and cut holes in it. And that's kind of a common DIY option. But still, it was a huge pain. And so when my son was born, I was doing the same thing again. And I was clipping my nursing bra back together after I got done pumping one day. And I'm just kind of, it hit me. I'm like, why can't something clip onto your bra? Like, that just seems like such an easy solution. I looked and there was nothing that did that. So I went to my basement and grabbed some old fabric from, I think it was like from a Halloween costume or something. And I started making a prototype in my dining room. And after a couple tries, I figured out what worked. And basically it just clips directly onto your nursing bra. It doesn't matter what brand it is. And then you insert your funnels from your breast pump and there you go. You can do it in under 30 seconds. It's really, really easy.
And it is totally hands-free.
Totally hands-free. I've driven while I'm using it. I've typed on the computer. I've chopped vegetables. Like, you know, you can pretty much do anything.
And I went to your website and watched the video you had. Totally discreet.
Yeah, yeah. And that was really an accidental benefit. Most of the other options, it's essentially the other ones are a bra, so you are still fairly exposed. And where mine is a full panel of fabric, it's a trapezoid. And yeah, it provides really a lot of additional coverage. So if you do have to pump and drive or, you know, at the airport or something like that, you're still probably going to want to, you know, be covered, but at least you're not totally exposed like you are in a bra.
So once you had this design, what did you do? Go calling up friends or how did you find women to test it out for you?
I used it for a couple months myself just to make sure, you know, that it was working. And then I'm a part of a bunch of breastfeeding groups on Facebook. And so I just reached out in one of them that was local and said, hey, I'm not trying to sell anybody anything. I just really want your honest feedback. And so I sent out about 10 of them. And I think it worked for everybody but one. And she just, her breasts were way too large for the size that I had at that time. And everybody, I got raving reviews. And I'm like, okay, so this doesn't just work for me. This is really a good idea. So then, you know, I knew that it was something I needed to pursue.
And is this something you envision someone being able to easily use at work?
Oh, absolutely. It just allows them to be able to continue on with their day. I mean, depending on your work, of course, but I work in a cubicle. And so instead of having to take, you know, breaks and not be able to get any work done, which isn't good for productivity and just, you know, puts you behind. And obviously your, you know, manager isn't going to want you to be stopping a couple times a day and everything like that. So it just allows you to keep on keeping on doing whatever you have to do. So absolutely, it's good for work.
As we alluded to at the beginning of our conversation, entrepreneurship is something that is very male-dominated to this point. And you've pitched this product to several innovation contests, presumably with a bunch of men in the room. So what was that like? What did you say to them?
Yeah, it's really funny because the first competition that I participated in, I was up against four men, and then the judges were five men, and the audience was about 90% men. So I had to come about it a different way because they're obviously not breastfeeding moms. And so I had to explain more about just what pumping entails to make them get it. And so I kind of went through a scenario of imagine 3 hours a day that you cannot use your hands. Like, how would you be able to finish your day? And they're kind of looking bewildered at me like, of course, I couldn't do that.
A very deft way to kind of put them into the position of a woman that has to take that time to pump. Now, you're selling the Pump and Do online?
Yeah, yep, it's available at pumpanddo.com and also on Amazon. And one small mom-and-pop type of a retailer in Grand Haven carries it today.
And I know you won the 2017 Innovate Her Challenge of West Michigan last month. You're proof that you can be someone who has a lot to do, yet carve out space to be an entrepreneur. So, Julie, what would your advice be to others starting out from the ground up, got an idea, and they want to get that idea to become reality and get it to market like you're doing?
I think the biggest thing is, if it's something that you're passionate about that you would do if you made no money, or, you know, it's not just about the next $1 million idea. Of course, everybody wants that. But if you're passionate about it, that will show through because entrepreneuring is not easy. It's, in fact, very, very difficult. I think on the outside, it's like, oh, that, you know, would be so great to work for yourself. It's going to be so fun. Yeah, parts of it are fun, but it's really a lot of work. And, you know, you can get discouraged really easily. So having something that you are truly passionate about makes all the difference.
Julie Burrell, creator of the Pump and Do, thank you so much for being a part of The Next Idea. It was great talking with you.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Marcel Price is on a mission. Use poetry and the spoken word to encourage young people to open up about mental health and wellness. As Fable the Poet, this young Michigander has been visiting high schools all around Michigan and across the country, helping kids understand their shared struggles. Now, he's taking all of this national with something he's calling the Unpacking Tour. Fable is back with us on Stateside. It's so good to see you.
It is so good to see you. Thank you for having us back.
And I want to welcome your partner in this national tour, the poet KFG, K. Foster Goodrich. KFG, so glad you're here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, what spurred the idea to package this as the Unpacking Tour and go national?
Well, we both have a very similar message. We both share a past of dealing with trauma, hardship, abuse, as well as we both have our own struggles with mental health. So one day, Kay gave me a call on their way back from Texas, I believe.
Yeah.
And was like, we should go on a tour. And I was like, all right, if you're about it, let's do it.
Yeah.
So for months and months and months, we started planning and getting all mapped out.
Yeah, it seemed like a great idea. I had just driven through the night, had pounded a 5-hour energy. The sun was rising. And I was like, yeah, I want to be on the road all the time. Who will travel with me? Fable, of course. Let's go.
So what will this tour consist of? What will you be doing?
Well, we'll be at a variety of venues all across the country. We're going to be starting out in North Carolina, South Carolina. We'll be in Texas, Florida, 15 states, yeah, something like that. We'll be going around to venues.
Pennsylvania, Colorado.
Oh, boy. Got to log a lot of miles. Yeah. Sitting in front of who?
It'll be a variety of individuals. It'll be people who are taking up normal, like, local nightlife, who are in clubs. Some of these places will be bookstores. Some of these places will be partnerships with organizations, like little branches of Mental Health America across the country. And it's going to be a variety of different individuals. And really what we're going to be doing is using poetry as a way to help people unpack, helping them talk about what they're going through and feel comfortable vocalizing it. Because too many times we have people, especially adults, who shove everything in a closet and is like, all right, I don't have to deal with it now.
Put it up on the back shelf, exactly. But it's festering away. And right. It's probably stuff they've carried since they were young people.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of taking the work you've been doing in high school, Fable, and blowing it up. And yeah. Trying to reach, you know, really on a national level.
Reaching those grown-ups. We're, right now, we're working with the kids and giving them these tools to express their emotions. And now we're able to reach adults and tell them that, like, hey, those things that you've been carrying since you were a kid, you don't have to carry for the rest of your life. You don't need to be ashamed of it. And you can have healthy, open communication with the people around you. And if you can plant that seed, it grows to a national, global scale.
Can you give me an idea of what you'll be doing? And how, like, I'm curious what kind of things you might say or do on stage that could be the key to unlock that.
Yeah. So really what we do is we kind of start with an icebreaker. We both like to tell stories. So we start off with stories that then weave in and out of our poetry. And in the middle of it, we take a brief pause. And we do, I'm not going to give you all the details, but what we do is we do an interactive exercise that gets all the adults to kind of step out of their shell and to be vulnerable with one another and to really express the things that they feel that they've been carrying. And then after that, we kind of go back into poetry to be a little bit more uplifting and to kind of like break the tension and to break the, oh my gosh, I was just so vulnerable around all these people who I don't know. And then we just go into sharing our stories. And then we do some that's a little bit lighter and funnier to then pick people back up. But it's just weaving in and out of story and poetry and interactive exercises, because in a lot of these places, a lot of people aren't really familiar with one another. like they might go to shows and see each other at shows all the time, but they really don't know the hardships one another share.
Well, when you think about it, in 2017, it's funny. I was driving around a couple of weekends ago in the lovely old city of Romeo in Macomb County, looking at those beautiful old homes that all go back to the mid-1800s up to the early 1900s, and they all had porches up in the front. And I was saying to my husband, who's Irish, we would all sit outside on our porches, America used to. Now, everybody's in the back on their deck, and you don't see each other, and you may not know the name of the person who lives next door to you. And that is an awfully isolating thing, whether we realize it or not, isn't it?
Yeah, that's very true. I think about where I grew up, where everybody was out on their porches. And now that I've moved to Grand Rapids, to the city, I don't necessarily see people out and about. You really have to make an effort to get connected with people nowadays. And because we have so much technology, we can kind of think that we are more connected. And in a way, we are. We're able to access more information and share more information in that way. But it's not as personal. It doesn't have the emotional human connection aspect of it, and you have to go out of your way to do that.
And Marcel, what price do you think we're paying as a society for that sense of not knowing who's living next door?
Oh, it's huge. The depersonalization of all of it, I mean, definitely pays a toll. I mean, we live in an era of tweets, and we live
behind a screen name.
We live behind a screen name. We live in a society that's almost more comfortable calling people out than pulling people in. And that's really the beauty behind this tour, is that we'll be able to pull people in and get people who might have opposing views to share in front of one another and to be vulnerable and to start, at least in this pocket, at that show, at that place, at that time, create a forum where people are comfortable getting to know one another and humanizing one another instead of tearing each other down.
Right. From a distance, once you have somebody far enough away, then all the details kind of melt into the background and you just have a stereotype standing
there. It's easy
there.
To otherize.
Yeah. You just treat somebody like a stereotype and not as the person. Once you get close to them, it's terrifying. It is vulnerable because it's like, okay, I'm going to get to know you and you're really going to get to know me. But that's where you can hash things out. You can actually have a conversation about these things.
I'm talking with the poet KFG and Fable the poet, West Michiganders, both of them heading on the road nationally with the Unpacking Tour, bringing a sense of a message of mental wellness and mental health, not only to young people, as you've been doing, but really all ages. And we have to talk about the fact, Fable, that you were recently named Poet Laureate for the city of Grand Rapids. What did that mean to get that award?
It's a huge honor. Words don't even, they won't even really describe it in full, just because it's so surreal. Like, I'm the first individual of color in Grand Rapids city history to ever hold laureateship. I'm the youngest person in city history. The youngest, I think, was age 40 before. It really blows me away. And I'm excited to be able to use my laureateship to get a lot of other artists in our city on larger stages and really to make a name for individuals who are trying to do positive work for positive results.
Exciting. I know. I can tell how proud you are.
I'm so looking proud.
Okay. Now, there's a tour all mapped up then? You're going to start out when?
Right now, the tour is all mapped out, but we're still definitely booking dates.
I was going to say, Michigan dates?
Yep. We do have a couple Michigan dates, but we're still looking to fill them. So if any organization is hearing this, any school is hearing this, if anybody's like, hey, we do work with youth or we do work around mental health, please reach out to us, contact us, because we're definitely happy to add dates to this.
And what would be a good website to do that?
You could reach out at theunpackingtour@gmail.com. Of course, you can always reach out via my website, www.mindoffable.com.
We'll put that on our website at michiganradio.org. I'm not letting you go without asking, give us a poem, give us something.
Ooh,
give us something to chew on.
Something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't mind us, because these poems are meant to be quiet. Said doctors about the child that was stillborn, moving. Said factors about the lifestyle we still live, yet soothing us more than the antidepressants, because isn't it depressing how life works sometimes, yet isn't it refreshing how life works sometimes? I'm sorry. I guess that must be the bipolar. When you're used to life looking like Saturday morning cartoons and you know why you love ninjas, pizza, and turtles, to not understanding why life's hurdles seem to match Berlin walls as you crumble to pharmaceutical commercials
because the jingle over the symptoms matches the dinner bell, and for some reason you're starving to feel normal.
Well, wonderful. So just a tiny taste of what people will be experiencing across the country on the Unpacking Tour offered by West Michigan Poets, KFG, and Fable the Poet. Best of luck, and we will be. It'll be fun. Come back and tell us what it was like after you've been across the country, you've learned, and how that's going to be informing your work in the future. KFG and Fable the Poet from West Michigan, thank you so very much for sharing your work with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is an important day for a retired West Michigan high school teacher and coach. At this hour, James McLuhan is at the White House receiving the nation's highest honor, the Congressional Medal of Honor. The 71-year-old Army medic's being honored for courage he displayed rescuing and treating wounded comrades during 2 days of a fierce battle in Vietnam in May of 1969, even though he himself had been hit with shrapnel and shot in the arm.
I would rather be dead than to have gotten on that helicopter and found out later on that someone else got killed because their medic wasn't there for him. That was my job.
James McLuhan of West Michigan receiving the Congressional Medal of Honor from President Trump at this very hour. Still to come, how to better connect philanthropic foundations to community groups already doing the work Detroit neighborhoods need. We'll learn more after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Philanthropic groups have played a central role in helping Detroit recover from the depths of its bankruptcy. But has that philanthropic giving been more top-down and not enough bottom-up, not bringing grassroots and neighborhood groups into the conversation about just what's needed and how those dollars can be best used? A new report from Allied Media Projects and Detroit People's Platform presents 2 years of research into these questions. Its title, Changing the Conversation, Philanthropic Funding and Community Organizing in Detroit. Here with us today is Jenny Lee of the Allied Media Projects. Good to have you here, Jenny.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome to Linda Campbell of the Building Movement Project and Detroit People's Platform. So good to have you here.
Thank you.
And from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, we have Program Officer Ed Ignatius. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Good to have you all here. Jenny, I want to start with you. There are 12 recommendations in this report. In broad strokes, what are those? What needs to be done differently in philanthropy and community organizing?
Broadly, those 12 recommendations are ideas for how the philanthropic community can begin by listening in terms of their approach to supporting systemic change in our city. They're recommendations about changes in the process of grant making and the approach of philanthropy, but they're also suggestions of the types of really innovative grassroots work that philanthropy could be supporting more of, that many people feel has been under-acknowledged and certainly under-resourced.
To that point, Linda Campbell, who are the people, who are the groups that you wanted to be sure are included in this discussion as this research report was being developed?
One of the really important outcomes of the research was the engagement of a number of small grassroots organizations that are led by people of color here in the city of Detroit. And it's often the case that those groups are doing pretty powerful work in their neighborhoods, in their community, and that work may not be always acknowledged to the extent that it should be. We find that these groups are doing a lot of solution making in their neighborhoods, and we wanted to bring them to the table, acknowledge their leadership, and give them an opportunity to have voice and give some direction about the future of our city as well.
And I can tell you're preaching to the choir. Ed's nodding. Yes. Ed, how important is it for philanthropic organizations to really hear from diverse voices in Detroit and really elsewhere as it's deciding where that money's going to go?
In this area of philanthropy, we tend to, as a group, probably think we have the answers. And at Kellogg, we have learned over many, many years, actually led by Mr. Kellogg himself, who really said that a community really has oftentimes the answers to their own concerns. They just need support. resources. They need some expertise maybe in planning, but it's really the community that has the solutions. So for us, that has been at the core of our work. And over the last 10 years, that has gotten even more at the very core of everything that we do at Kellogg. So I couldn't agree 100% more with the aims of this effort. We participated in the conversation, and we have learned a great deal in listening to the voices that Linda referred to, you know, in terms of our work in Detroit.
Jenny, there have been generations of systemic inequality and racism. So what do conversations with influential partners do to move the needle here and kind of at least acknowledge these problems?
Yeah, I think part of it is about acknowledging the problems and also seeing the same problems maybe from just different dimensions. So historically, you know, the foundations in Detroit, the grassroots communities have been looking together at some of the same problems, but just understanding them differently in terms of what the roots of those problems are and what really holistic solutions to those problems might look like. That was what was most fascinating about the process of putting together this report. Take an issue like water shutoffs, groups like Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, We the People of Detroit, People's Water Board, think about that problem in terms of how do we create a structural solution like water affordability versus simply just ease the pain of shutoffs through more charitable efforts.
That's the exciting part of this work. You know, everyone knows the recent history of Detroit around the bankruptcy and the emergency management, which left a lot of our community feeling sort of locked out of the processes around reshaping the future of Detroit. And so in an effort for community to sort of set their stake and bring their voice into here's our vision for the future, here's what we think are solutions to some of the systemic problems, you do find groups like People's Water Board that Jenny just mentioned who are looking more systemically around the issues of development. I mean, there's an incredible amount of revitalization and investment that's happening in Detroit. Sure, we all want to see our city thrive and we welcome investment, but not investment at any cost. And so many of us have come to the table and sort of fashioned out a vision for what does equitable and just development look like in the city of Detroit at this time? Who are the people who should be at the table helping to interface with developers around, you know, here are ways to help us create sustainable and vital communities beyond just the bricks and mortar of your particular project.
Can you give us a for instance of some type of philanthropic initiative? You don't even have to name names as far as who did it, but like how was something constructed that could have been better if there had been more community involvement and a voice?
You know, there is really a standard principle. Each foundation, you know, has a board. Each foundation has a set of missions. And we could clearly break it into two types of groups. One type of foundation is into charitable transactions. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's very wonderful. And it oftentimes fills needs in community and responds to the community. And, you know, community foundations oftentimes are really crucial in terms of that. Another type of foundation is more of a strategic foundation. It has a plan. It has a kind of a set priorities that are really much tighter and much more focused on getting something done. So clearly, even within that strategic group, there is a range of different foundations. We at Kellogg fall in that ladder. We have a very strong emphasis on early childhood and a very strong emphasis that you cannot support a really strong early childhood change in the way things are in Detroit or any place if you can't also look at the systems that have to change. And part of that is employment. So moms and dads have to have work and meaningful income that is above poverty, or else those young people don't have a shot, even with the good work that foundations will do. Some foundations think that they would craft that strategy in their rooms and then announce it and then kind of implement it. And
here
then,
you go. Roll this right, out. Here you are. Like almost a silver platter. That's here's right, our gift. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And in fact, some big foundations, you know, have been accused of helicoptering into a place and kind of saying, we're going to help save you. I'm very proud that the W.K. Kellogg Foundation has a really different
approach,
spin on that.
Yes.
And we really believe that it's not just Mr. Kellogg. It's really good work acknowledges and works with the community So it's not something you do to the community, it's something you do with the community. Mm-hmm. And that you start with some really core principles. And so for us, those core principles are two that cut across all our work. And that is, number one, community engagement. We really believe that residents need to not only be at the table, not just giving input. You know, some people think that that means just sending a text. I don't believe that's real true engagement.
Or filing a public comment of some kind.
That's right. Engagement really is about empowerment. It's really about at the table at the beginning, at the table to look at drafts, and at the table at the implementation, and then co-owning the solutions. The second part, and I know this is very special because not many foundations have committed. In 2007, our organization, our board, committed to be an anti-racist organization. And we have evolved even since then to be committed to racial healing, to be committed to a new narrative, and to be committed to helping our nation become a racially equitable nation that serves all children and helps all children to thrive.
Such an important point around engagement that brings people who are going to be impacted by funding to the table. And I think one complementary strategy that we learned a lot about in the process of making this report is just the idea that sometimes, rather than thinking of solution building as an effort to bring people to a table, we can find deeper solutions by identifying where tables already exist. Where are people already acting on a problem in some fashion? And how can we lend our support to those efforts? Because probably those are going to be the more sustainable, the more strategic, the more appropriate for a community who's grappling with a problem. So I think a lot of what the work Linda and I are trying to do is shift the way of thinking towards more of that approach to identify where these tables already exist.
It certainly sounds like what you're expressing is very, very much at the core of this new report. We're talking about a new report called Changing the Conversation, Philanthropic Funding and Community Organizing in Detroit, as we talk with Jenny Lee of the Allied Media Projects, with Linda Campbell of Building Movement Project and the Detroit People's Platform, and from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, Ed Ignatius, looking at philanthropy and really making those philanthropic dollars just work better and be more effective if they're going out. And one of the questions, I'll start with you, Jenny, on this, and then everybody chime in. Development dollars in Detroit really tend to be focused on downtown and midtown. What kind of challenges does that pose to community leaders and the grassroots groups in neighborhoods to get some of that philanthropic action?
I think the starting point is, again, to kind of Linda's point, that development dollars alone are not enough to address the deep-rooted and systemic problems that neighborhoods are grappling with. There has to be a way to say, first of all, what is this neighborhood's vision for its own future, and investment in the work of developing that out before we even start talking about how to lure more business in. Fortunately, there are examples of incredible grassroots efforts to do that. The one that comes immediately to mind for me is the Restore Northeast Detroit Coalition, which spent several years developing what they called a visionary land use plan for District 3, Detroit's Northeast District. And within that is a lot about what they want to see happen and what they don't. And so to be able to then engage with developers who come in saying, well, I want to expand a hazardous waste treatment facility in your district, which is in fact a proposal on the table. What we need is more investment in residents' ability to say no to things like that, in addition to being able to say yes to the establishment of a new town center at a certain intersection with new businesses.
Because who knows better than right. The people who are going to live with that in their front or backyards?
I would agree. And as I mentioned earlier, there's an incredible amount of development that's coming into the city of Detroit. A great percentage of that is fueled by corporate investment, but there's also a lot of public investment in that as well. So what we see is public resources being used for private economic development, and that's an important recognition for citizens to be aware of, because what it says is that you're just not innocent bystanders, you are public investors, and therefore you deserve to have some voice and power in decisions that are being made about where those development dollars and public investment is happening in the city. And to be effective in that strategy, there's a need for community organizing on the level where we're giving and equipping community members with new tools, such as community benefit agreements, you know, helping folks sort of understand how you can create these win-win situations with developers where a community sort of outlines, here are the quality of life improvements we would like to see in our community alongside what's happening in downtown or midtown. There's a movement afoot in Detroit now to build community and citizen capacity to be actively engaged on that level of decision-making in development, too.
I couldn't agree more, and I want to give you an example. We at the Kellogg Foundation are very proud that we fund in Detroit a very strong support for community benefits, and that we're one of the only local funders that support that. It was a little controversial, it was a little hot, but this was long before there was any discussion about how to make that into a law, because we don't get involved with laws and things like that. But we were very supportive of the idea that the benefits need to be for residents, and that when development comes in, a smart business, a thoughtful business, wants residents to own the solution. And so there were examples of private agreements that were worked out between residents and that investor. And three of them come to mind. And what happened in those, it's not just a question of residents wanting to do that. It's residents, and Linda really pointed it out, having the capacity and the training and the background and the resources behind them to do the serious research to say, you're going to benefit from this. I know it was not as easy as I sometimes make it sound, but Whole Foods, you know, was a really good example who came into Detroit, wanted to sit down with residents. It was a struggle at first, but Whole Foods, its employment is 71% Detroiters. And the shoppers, as much folks of color and residents of the city who have been longtime residents as it is some of the more newcomer residents.
What do you hope that this report and this 2 years worth of work that's gone into creating this report, what will it mean for helping philanthropic groups help people?
So two things. One is that we're excited to see this report shift the practices of foundations themselves. And I think Ed can speak to the ways in which Kellogg Foundation has actually used the 12 recommendations in this document to further conversations within their own institution. The other piece of it is that our goal with this is actually to lead to the creation of a new fund in Detroit that would be the first explicitly dedicated to supporting social justice and grassroots community organizing in the city. We are in the early stages through support from the Ford Foundation of developing the vision for what that fund would do. We also see it as an invitation for not just to be re-granting, you know, funds from the major existing foundations, but for more of the individual donors in Southeast Michigan who want a place to pass their gifts through that is maybe looking at issues from more of a systemic social justice lens.
It seems this is taking something that might have worked in the mid-20th century, in the 30s and the 40s, and moving it up to take us into the 21st century.
Yeah, I would say we think of it as a pretty transformative idea. Besides Jenny and myself, there's been a collection of groups from across the city of Detroit who've helped to bring the work this far. And it's happening right alongside that there's this energy around the revitalization of the city. And we think it's time to have a new set of ideas, new set of practices for philanthropy, as well as allowing grassroots groups to sort of take the leadership in forming solutions for our city as well.
Ed, last word for you.
Basically, we were very excited to be a part of the dialogue that started this process. As a result of that, we then took the first draft, 12 recommendations, and we used it for our Michigan team because we have a deep commitment to Grand Rapids, Battle Creek, and the city of Detroit.
Because this is going to be felt outside of the city. Absolutely.
That's correct. So we actually felt that because of those voices that were very articulate and very strong on what those 12 recommendations are, we felt it was a way of checking our work. How are we doing? Are we doing enough? What are we doing? What needs to be adjusted further? So that was really helpful. And I think the implication is that maybe our colleagues should do more of that. And I would certainly encourage that and support Jenny and Linda's efforts to get that. For us, it really is about walking the talk. If we're serious about community empowerment, then we have to acknowledge and work when the community empowerment pushes back on us.
The report is Changing the Conversation, Philanthropic Funding and Community Organizing in Detroit, as we've been talking with Jenny Lee of the Allied Media Projects, Linda Campbell, Building Movement Project and Detroit People's Platform, and from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation Program Officer, Ed Ignatius. Great to have you all with us. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much to listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.